The following is a production of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. For more information about the seminary, how you can support it, or applying to become a student, please visit www.gpts.edu. Hello and welcome to another edition of Confessing Our Hope, the podcast of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. My name is Zach Groff and I'm your host. I'm also the Director of Advancement and Admissions at Greenville Seminary in Greenville, South Carolina. But today I am in Columbia, South Carolina with Dr. Derek Thomas, Senior Minister of First Presbyterian Church in Columbia, to talk about one of his most recent publications. In fact, his most recent book as of the recording of this podcast. Dr. Thomas, thank you for welcoming me into your office.
You are most welcome, and welcome to Columbia.
Dr. Thomas is not only senior minister here at First Presbyterian Church, but he's also Chancellor's Professor of Systematic and Pastoral Theology at Reformed Theological Seminary and a teaching fellow with Ligonier Ministries. Dr. Thomas previously served as chairman of the theology department at RTS in Jackson, and today we are discussing his book, Heaven on Earth, What the Bible Teaches About Life to Come. And what I like to do in my interviews with authors, Dr. Thomas, is kick off the conversation by asking, why write this book, especially a book on heaven when so many already exist?
That's a really good question. And Randy Alcon's book on heaven is a very good book, though he often, I think, engages in a little bit of speculation. And perhaps I do to some extent in this book, too. I was encountering a number of questions by folk in the congregation about heaven, and typically the question, are there dogs in heaven? And my answer to that is, of course there are dogs in heaven. Why would there not be? And they are thinking sometimes in a confused manner, confusing what we would technically call the intermediate state and the final state. So in the intermediate state, you know, what happens to you 5 seconds after you're dead? And as a Christian, as a believer, we believe that our souls are immediately in the presence of Christ in a disembodied condition, although I have no idea how to understand that. To be frank, and there is an ongoing debate about whether that intermediate state is a totally disembodied, non-physical state. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4 that if this earthly tent is destroyed, we have a building, and uses the present tense, not that we will have, but we have a building. And there's some Reformed discussion as to exactly what that means. And Calvin, I think, is somewhat ambiguous about that disembodied state in the intermediate state. But that's not what people are generally thinking about when they say heaven. They're not thinking of the intermediate state. They're thinking of the final state. And the final state really isn't called heaven. It's called the new heavens and new earth. And that looks like this. Buildings, trees, rivers, seas.
Dogs.
And dogs. I think it is, and I'd love to expand on it a little more if time allows, but I think it is a restoration of creation as it was and would have been if Adam and Eve had not sinned. What would the world look like?
Now, you said the impetus for the book came out of questions from congregants, people in your church that you're pastoring. And typically, most churches aren't large enough to justify the writing of a small book to answer recurring questions. Now, your church is more sizable than many other Reformed and Presbyterian churches, so maybe you could get away with writing a pamphlet or a small book to answer these questions. But was there a step before the publishing of the book?
Yes, there was. And this book was generated out of a series of sermons that I preached. But I knew going into that this would be a book. Most of the books I've written and I've written 25, 6, 7, 8, somewhere around there. Most of them have been sermon series initially, especially commentaries that I've written. And I would find it very difficult to go back and simply write from scratch a book, although I have done that this spring, another book on scripture for the Banner of Truth, which was published a few weeks ago. And but this one was most definitely a series, and I forget how many, 8 or 9, 10 sermons that I did about a year ago, and was able to sort of write up the chapters in advance. And then at the end of the series, you've got something that needs to be edited. And there's a difference of style between preaching and talking and the written word. We have a wonderful folk in our congregation who have second homes in rather nice places, and they loaned me their home for a few days so that I could go and just finish off this book.
That is a wonderful providence. What a good gift. And in this book, you're working through 7 discrete sermons that you're tying together into one small volume that's going to serve lay people. This isn't a highly technical read. It took me a few hours to read it. I wasn't racing through it, but I also wasn't slogging through technical jargon and lingo, because the picture you present of heaven is one that is very concrete and one that comes alive in your mind as you're reading the book. But for our listeners, how should we think about heaven? You've already said it's like this. There are things there, but what are some of the qualities of heaven that might differentiate it from what we experience day to day right now?
Well, again, I think we need to be clear what we are talking about, and I'm not talking about the intermediate state. Now, when I die, I have an assurance that I will go and be with Jesus, and that is a geographical area. Jesus's body is somewhere. His physical, resurrected, ascended body is in space and time. Mm-hmm. It exists somewhere. Often referred to Yuri Gagarin in the 1960s, Sputnik, the Russian cosmonaut who went up into space, and being the vassal of the communist era that he was, looked out the window and said to the world, you know, he looked for God and didn't see him. And, you know, the guy was an idiot. He didn't go far enough. Because somewhere in this universe, the body of Jesus is. And I don't know where that is. And is it in a rent in space? Is it in a parallel universe? I have no idea, but it could be. But it's somewhere. And it exists. And that's where we will be in that intermediate state. But we are now asking about the final state after Jesus comes, and we'll avoid all of the eschatological questions about things that happen before and after Jesus comes, and the whole panorama of events that accompany the second coming. But the creation or the transformation of this fallen universe into the new heavens and new earth. There was a debate in the 16th century between the Lutherans and the Calvinists on the nature of the new heavens and new earth. And the Lutherans described it in terms and took that passage in the New Testament that this world will be burnt up in Peter, and took that literally and said that this universe will be totally destroyed and God will bring into being a totally new universe. And the Calvinists said no, it wasn't bringing in something new, it was a restoration, because atoms and molecules and gravity and electromagnetism is not in itself sinful. And because of a predominant, I think, doctrine of common grace within the universe, the Calvinists argued that the new heavens and new earth would be like this. It would look like this. Imagine the world if there'd been no sin.
We could recognize it.
You could recognize it. We will recognize each other, and therefore our resurrected bodies will have a resemblance to this body. And I think that if you accept the paradigm that Jesus's resurrection body is a glimpse of the kind of body that you will have in the new heavens and new earth. Now, you could argue that there is a further transformation from the resurrection to the ascension. But in the resurrection body, Jesus did a number of things. First of all, that resurrection body seemed to be subject to the laws of gravity. It didn't rise, and therefore the ascension has to be explained in some way. I remember teaching a course at seminary on eschatology, and we were talking about the ascension, and somebody put his hand up, or I think just shouted out and said, how could he breathe? And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, if he rises, if he went up into the clouds, how could he breathe? And I thought to myself, you know, I've never thought about that in my entire life, but now that you ask the question, actually it's a very good question, because it presupposes the fact that Jesus' resurrection body required oxygen, that he breathed, that his lungs went in and out, and even his ascended body continued to breathe, and therefore in the intermediate state, wherever that is, it is in an environment that has oxygen. Assuming that the ascended body is a continuity with the resurrection body. Well, the new heavens and new earth, I fully expect to have oxygen. And we are corporeal and we are subject to the laws of gravity. We're not floating about in space. And if we go back once again to the resurrection body of Jesus as a paradigm, and Paul seems to suggest in 1 Corinthians 15, in his extended discussion of the resurrection, that the resurrection body of Jesus is indeed a paradigm of our resurrection bodies. Jesus ate fish at a breakfast in Galilee. And there are all kinds of repercussions and consequences to eating that require us to think through in fairly crass and detailed ways that Jesus' resurrection body had a certain biological structure that could take in food. In Star Trek, Voyager... is it Voyager? No, Star Trek, the original Star Trek with Data, the android. I forgot now which edition of Star Trek that is, but every time there was a meal, he didn't eat. He just sat there at the table and he didn't eat. He didn't require nutrients. Well, it appears as though Jesus' resurrection body requires nutrients. It requires food. And I think that cements, that solidifies, pun intended in this case, that solidifies what the nature of the resurrection body of Jesus is and what it's like, and therefore what heaven, as people colloquially refer to heaven, not the intermediate state but the end state, what the final state will be. And so corporeal bodies that have the ability of recognition.
And sensation.
And sensation.
Biological process.
Right. And therefore, we need to think carefully about what we mean when we say that there'll be no pain in heaven. You know, C.S. Lewis has a very interesting essay in his book on the problem of pain on that, and he says, you know, that not all pain is bad. Some pain is good pain. If you stick your hand in the fire, your body says, this hurts, and you pull it out again. So will there be, you know, do we have sensory ability in our resurrection body? When you touch, can you feel? Can you feel something's hot or cold? Can you feel something's very hot and very cold? And therefore, I don't see why not. And I think that Christians generally still think of heaven, still using that term, or better, they think of the new heavens and new earth in Platonic terms.
Explain that. What do you mean by Platonic terms?
That the physical is the secondary and the primary and the good and the real is the spiritual, the non-corporeal. And for the Greeks generally, and so this wave of culture and philosophical thinking coming right up to the time of Jesus and the first century apostles, the prevailing cultural thought about the afterlife was that it was non-material, that it was in the form of some sort of vapor but non-material, and even the concept of vapor is a material concept.
It was pure ideal.
Pure ideal. And the New Testament knocks that on the head, but you see that. When I was converted almost 50 years ago now, but I had this love for classical music, I bordering on obsession, and too long a story to go into in detail, but I was mentored in my first year by someone who said to me I needed to get rid of these records, and they belonged to my grandfather, and he had bequeathed them to me when he died, and he died when I was 5, and he brought me into his room and told me he was going to leave them to me and so on. So there was that part of it too, but behind that piece of advice was a typical somewhat fundamentalist Christian view that there's something sinful about almost everything in this world, and about pleasure itself, and about the arts, and that Christian piety consists in withdrawal. And you see that both in Protestant circles, but you see it in Catholic circles too, and the whole monastic movement of withdrawal is a part of that. And I think that was part of the debate in the 16th century between the Lutherans and the Calvinists, that the Lutherans still retained that notion that piety consists in withdrawal rather than embracing and reforming and transforming. And so when we think about the final state of believers, I really do think that when people ask, are there dogs in heaven, I always say, well, of course there are dogs in heaven. Not so sure about cats, but there are definitely dogs in heaven. And not because I want to be sentimental. I actually want to think of that final state in very, very concrete terms, and concrete enough that it has the inclusion, I think, of, actually, I believe that all of God's creatures will be there. Sometimes people allude to Revelation 22, and John says, and there'll be no more sea. As though, and there are some books on heaven that suggest that there'll be rivers in the new world, in the new heavens and new earth, but no sea, no salt, saline oceans, and therefore no saltwater fish, and no whales and dolphins and so on, but river fish, clean water fish, non-salt fish. You can tell I'm not a fisherman.
Freshwater fish. I'm not a fisherman either.
Right. And that's I think that's a misunderstanding of Revelation 22, and I think that the sea, and there are several possibilities, and not least one that the sea is actually a reference to a bronze laver that contained water for ritual purification in the temple and so on. So it's a temple reference rather than a reference that there be no oceans in the new heavens and new earth. You know, I often think of it in this way. What was the mandate given to Adam and Eve in the garden? And that mandate was exploration and research and exercising dominion. And I think that's exactly the mandate that will be given to us in the new heavens and new earth. So when we get to the new heavens and new earth, let's avoid the intermediate state for a minute. When we get to the new heavens and new earth, it's not as though I will expect gigabytes of information to be downloaded into my brain and that all of a sudden I'll know stuff that I didn't know before. And that may be true, that I will have and be made aware of immediately knowledge that I don't have here. But I fully expect there to be a process of acquisition of knowledge and information in the same way that it takes place here. You ask questions, you investigate, you experiment, you learn. And I fully expect the new heavens and new earth to be temporal. I don't think it's outside of time. I think it's within time. God is outside of time. That's another debate for another season. But God is timeless, but we exist in space and time. And I think that our current understanding of the universe is that time and space are related together. Therefore, I fully expect the new heavens and new earth to be within a spatial and temporal existence.
Fundamentally, the new heavens and new earth are still creations. There's still creation, which means it's distinct from the creator. One of the main, most basic distinctions between creator and created, as far as we observe and as far as it's been revealed to us in Scripture, is the distinction that creation occupies space, finite space, and experiences temporality or time, whereas the creator does not is not limited to finite space. He's infinite and everywhere. And also, he's not limited to temporality and time. He steps into time in the person of Jesus Christ. He operates in time. He interacts with his creation in time, but he exists outside of it. And so why would the new creation be different on that score? Why would we not be experiencing time as created beings? But I want to back up to the introduction of the creation mandate into our conversation here. Jesus Christ points out, and you highlight this in the book at one point, that there is no marriage in heaven. But marriage, like labor and exploration and exercise of dominion, is something that's given and instituted at creation. So why would we assume then that we will have creative pursuits in heaven, labor, exercise of dominion, when we're told very plainly that another basic pillar of human experience from Adam and Eve, this institution of marriage, will be going away in the new heavens and new earth?
Yes, I don't know that I have an answer to the question, why are some things continuous and some things discontinuous? And marriage is discontinuous because of a dominical word, because Jesus said so. So there's no procreation. There are no babies born in the new heavens and new earth. The number is fixed. And a million questions arise to which I have no answers, and you reach a point where, you know, I would hear the voice of Calvin saying, you know, we must not engage in speculation. But the mandate to acquire knowledge seems to me to be conducive to an environment in which we will not know fully and nor have experienced it fully. And there are parts of this universe that we have never seen, and at least in this existence, as we currently know it, you know, we might be able to get to Mars, and we might still be alive if and when that takes place. But we are never going to see the Milky Way or what's on the other side in the fourth quadrant of the universe. And is that forever to be the case, or is part of living in the new heavens and new earth a continual exploration of the amazing universe that God has prepared for us? And I don't know. I can ask the question. I think that we will acquire knowledge. I think that there will still be the experience of, oh, I didn't know that, and now I do know that. Now I wasn't there before, but I'm there before, so I acquire knowledge. And so that's part of what investigation is. And therefore, the pursuit of creative gifts of art, of music, of architecture, or whatever, is still a part. I do not envisage the new heavens and new earth to be completely static. I don't envisage the new heavens to be one long sort of Sunday morning worship service that just never ends. All of life will be worship. The temple will be everywhere. The whole creation will be temple. And I think that's a theme, and it's one that's current just now. And one thinks of Greg Beale and New Testament theology and the importance of a particular understanding of the book of Revelation that seems to have been favored. And all of that, I think, is part of our understanding, I think, of the new heavens and new earth. There'll be things to do and things to create and things to enjoy. But there's also discontinuity, and marriage is one of them, and presumably sex is another. And that creates issues of further discussion, which I'll let you answer. But I don't know. I don't understand that. I mean, I don't have answers to that. All I know is that it will be not just good, but very good. It will be exactly as God intends it to be and as he created us to enjoy and find fulfillment in. And therefore, it's the concreteness of the new heavens and new earth that really was my burden to mm-hmm. get across, because I still find a lot of Christians thinking in
Gnostic terms.
Gnostic, Neoplatonic terms.
Now, there's the opposite extreme as well, the materialist extreme, where Christian materialism, if we wanted to call it that, it would really be pseudo-Christian materialism. You have pseudo-Christian Gnosticism that we're pushing against, but also on the other side, you have the view that when our bodies die, our souls go to sleep, and then they're wakened up with our bodies at the last day. And I think that's a crude way of putting a reigning assumption that a lot of Christians have, and even some Anabaptist thinkers have sought to systematize and articulate the doctrine of soul sleep. You touch on that in your book. Can you explain where that misses the mark and what that is saying about humanity that is inaccurate and outside of the counsel of Scripture?
I think that Jesus' words to the dying thief are crucial. Today, you will be with me in paradise. Now, I know that there are translations that suggest that what Jesus is saying, I'm saying to you today, comma, pause, you will be with me in paradise, allowing for a soul sleep. But I think that the Greek text is perfectly clear on this issue, that Jesus intended the dying thief to understand that there would be continuity of consciousness from the moment of his death to the moment that he is in Jesus' presence in paradise. Interesting that, you know, it was one of the first books that Calvin wrote in the 16th century was Psychopanikia, and before the Institutes, so in that period in the early 1530s, before he came to Geneva, he had published this little book addressing the issue of soul sleep. And Seventh-day Adventists and others, and for different reasons, advocate a very similar view. An inability to conceive of existence apart from the physical, apart from the body. And it is important to say, you know, it's not that we have a soul. I don't like that language. I think that, too, is a Platonic way of describing soul. I think we are a soul. Do animals have souls? And Christians are very, very fixed and certain in that they do not have souls. But actually, I'm not sure what they're talking about, because the Hebrew text of Genesis 1 uses the same word, nephesh, for Adam and Eve as it does for animals. Meaning that they are alive.
Spirit of life, yeah.
Right. So what soul means is life. It means consciousness. You know, what are you 5 seconds after your body is dead, when there are no brain waves? However you define death, there are no brain waves. You are still alive. You still exist. You are still self-aware. You still have consciousness. And therefore, consciousness is something. And interesting, we have one of the world's leading experts on the brain here in our congregation, and it's written a 1,000-page book that every doctor in South Carolina has read, I understand, on the brain. And I was asking him, are physical scientists who study the brain, are they ready yet to give an explanation for consciousness? And the answer is absolutely not. That the chemistry doesn't allow for a valid explanation of consciousness. So consciousness and self-awareness certainly involves the brain in some way, but there is more to self-awareness and consciousness than the brain. And we glimpse it in that sometimes we do have that sort of out-of-body experience. And I don't want to go too far on that, but we can certainly think of ourselves and be aware of ourselves apart from the body. And I think that's important when we're talking about the continuity of life, or the soul, or the spirit, or self-awareness and consciousness. And more often than not, that's how I think about souls, that when you die, your soul, meaning your self-awareness, your self-consciousness of who you are, continues.
Does something change to the souls of believers at their death when they are separated from their bodies and brought into the presence of Christ, as Jesus promised the thief on the cross, or declared to the thief on the cross?
Yes, in the sense of the fullness of sanctification, they are made perfectly holy, as the Catechism says. So sin affects body and soul. Sin affects our understanding of who we are and the way we understand who we are. So therefore, at death, our souls are made perfectly holy. But again, I have no means of fully understanding what that is like apart from the body, because I've never really experienced that. I just believe that is possible from what Jesus said to the dying thief in particular. And I think those words are crucially important.
And we will have that experience, though we don't have it now. We will have it. And in that sense, can the Christian then, this is more of a pastoral question, can the Christian, should we look forward to that day of death, or should we tremble and seek to cling on to life as much as we can. How do we pastorally wrestle with that particular issue, either facing imminent death or even just looking at it afar off from the vantage point of youth and vitality?
Yes, I mean, that's a good question. And I think that the tension that Paul expresses in Philippians 1, that he has a desire to depart and to be with Christ, but he also has a desire to live on and fulfill the mission that God has given to him. And you see the apostle wrestling with that. And therefore, Christians shouldn't have a sort of death wish that they're just longing to die. But I do think that we ought to have an anticipation of and a longing for what it means. And Puritans used to speak about being ready to die, living as though packed and ready to go. That famous answer that John Wesley gave when he was asked what would he do tomorrow if he knew it was to be his last day, and he opened his diary and looked and he said, "I would do exactly as I planned to do." And having the sanctification to live with that, having an assurance, gospel assurance, that when we die we will be in heaven, not because we're good enough or we've earned enough merits, but because of the grace of God in the gospel, that all of our sins have been dealt with by Christ. But God has given to each one of us a calling, a task, a mission to fulfill. And it's natural. You know, I want to see my grandchildren grow up, and I want to see them graduate from high school. I want to see them going off to college. I want to see them marrying and having children of their own. I mean, those are perfectly natural, good Christian aspirations to have. But Deo volente, if God willing, only if the Lord wills it. And so I think we live in that tension between having a desire to depart, but also having a desire to remain. And, you know, the older you get, the more you think along those lines. You plan for the future. You make reasonable plans. You have a retirement account. You take out insurance. Because there is seemingly an expectation that you will live, but you don't know. So I think Christians live in that tension.
How can we prepare ourselves for those twilight years, and in fact that very moment when we depart to go home to be with the Lord? What pastoral advice do you give in this book, or you would give even outside of what you covered in the book, to believers who sincerely want to pursue godliness in preparation for departure?
Yes, and therefore we should live with short accounts. I think that there is a reasonable sense of piety that suggests in the rhythm of daily life, you know, that you pray every day, you close out each day, you know, as you close your eyes, if it is God's will that they open again in the morning. And there's a child's prayer that we sometimes teach our children that suggests that. And one of the things I think that we should be careful about is, you know, not to live our lives as though we have no calling, no sense of conviction as to what it is we are supposed to do in this world. You know, I think the closer you are to 80 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, and so on, the closer you get to that, the more you realize how short life is and how much we waste our time on things that are trivial and things, and especially things that are sinful, and therefore pursuing godliness, pursuing holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, pursuing that lifestyle of mortification and cross-bearing and meditation on the life to come, those three things that Calvin mentions in the third book of the Institutes.
As we think further about pastoral issues, and this maybe brings us full circle back to the beginning of our conversation, in this little book you cover so much ground on the subject in just really just 112 pages or so. But what would you want to leave our listeners with in terms of the number one correction of a popular misconception about heaven, the afterlife? It could be about the intermediate state, the final state, whatever. What is the number one area of pastoral counsel you would want to give to the Christian on the street about his or her perception about heaven?
Can I have two?
You can have two.
The first is that you can be sure about going to heaven, but you can also be sure about going to hell if you don't believe in the gospel, if you don't believe in Jesus Christ. So everyone isn't going to heaven, and everyone who thinks they're going to heaven isn't going to heaven either. So the key here to being certain about heaven when I die is the gospel. So there's a gospel motive here. But the number one issue that I confront all the time is the suspicion that heaven is something ethereal, floating on clouds, plucking harps, having angel wings or something of that nature.
That heaven is a terrible bore.
Right, to be perfectly honest. I really want to dispel that. And I want them to view it, the final state, as something very concrete and very similar in certain ways to the way we experience the cosmos today.
I love what you write toward the end of the book here. You say, our resurrection bodies will similarly bear a weightiness and significance suited for the experience of seeing Christ face to face, as it says in 1 Corinthians 13:12. I can hardly wait. It is going to be an adventure. And then just a couple pages later in your postscript, you say, heaven is where we dream and grow and play and work along with all the redeemed saints. In its final form, heaven is a new earth, mountains, oceans, rivers, lakes, forests, sandy beaches, birds, fish, animals of every kind, and dogs. Sweet dogs to play and run with, all God's creation now restored for us to explore and investigate and try to understand. And that's just the written version of what you've said earlier in this short conversation we've had. I hope to our listeners, I hope this whets your appetite to pick up this book, to read more of heaven, of our eternal, not just resting place, but our eternal sandbox, as it were, where we will run and play and explore and continue to experience God's goodness in creation, even as we behold him face to face. The book is available from Christian Focus, and I refer you to christianfocus.com. It's also available on Amazon and other good fine booksellers like Reformation Heritage Books and Westminster Bookstore. It's $12.99 is the retail price, but I encourage you to go check it out online to see what these other vendors are selling it for. And Dr. Thomas, I also like to ask authors to refer other books. You mentioned Randy Alcorn, but what other books did you come across that were helpful to you in terms of thinking through these issues, putting pen to paper, and writing a book of your own? What other resources would you direct us to?
Hookmer on the Bible and the life hereafter, which is a fairly massive book on eschatology, dealing with all kinds of things. But his chapters on heaven and the new heavens and new earth were very, very helpful indeed. But there are also some chapters in J.C. Ryle that were very helpful to me, and in Holiness and Practical Religion, that I thought were very helpful.
There you have it. I thank you for your time, Dr. Thomas. This has been an enlightening conversation and one that has made me think again about how exciting the prospect of life with God is, not just here, though that is certainly such a great and exciting prospect as we grow in grace and godliness and acquaintance with our Lord, but even in the hereafter. When we go and after the trumpet sounds and the heavens and the earth are restored and Christ reigns consummately and beholding him face to face and yet still experiencing all the goodness that he gives his creation. Thank you for your time and for this interview.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a production of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. For more information about the seminary, please visit www.gpts.edu.